quintessential Chris Hillman. Prologue. March 1996. Julia Green clicked the handle, and the wind almost pulled the door out of her hand, but she knew it would be stronger, near the edge. She had known Beachy Head since she was a child. The pathways were as familiar to her as her garden path. The views over the sea were something she clung to, familiar but ever-changing. It was windy in the car park, it would be terrifying nearer the top. But it was her place, the place she loved and where she always turned. The thrash of the waves, against the rocks hundreds of feet below, a distant soundscape to a visit. A crashing white noise that allowed Julia to empty her mind. Julia let the wind slam the door and mounted the turf on the pathways she had trodden so many times before. As she left the lit streets of Eastbourne and headed onto the moorland, the rain had become aggressive. Now, her headlamps were reflecting away from her, only the glint on the curbside picking out the roadway. As Julia climbed the path, she secured her anorak zip against the rain. This was somewhere she could walk and think. She had plundered it for inspiration, and it never failed, never let her down. It had been her friend, and it would be her friend again. For a second, her mind drifted back to picnics in the car. The windows, steaming, coffee from a flask and flat sandwiches from a metal box with a green lid. But there was no picnic today, no walk on the downs with her parents, no search for inspiration, just a churning deep inside. Alone again, she would soon be running back to her sanctuary in the Cotswolds without a job. Away from the stress of the school. The wealthy few, paying for their privileged daughters to become the new aristocracy. They had been together for too long to leave on a whim, 4 years of her life given to someone she loved. But events, dear boy, events, that was the quote. Julia snorted a silent laugh. And even that's not genuine. The past 4 years with Charlotte had been a glorious oasis from the school. A school that she had loved and a job she relished, at first. How easily things change, smiles soured, backs turned. But it was Charlotte's change that had eroded the safety of their flat. Evenings they had spent together, Julia now spent alone. Living with someone, but not as partners. Then the photographs appeared on the notice board. Dark and grainy images. Deep blacks and pure burnt-out whites. Almost indistinguishable, almost. But you didn't need to be a genius to read them. Two people in a car, their heads together. A blonde girl and the dark-haired, lesbian art teacher. Now she was near the top, in the distance, she could look down on Eastbourne, 5 miles below her. Knew that on the beach, the sea would be thrashing the shingle remorselessly, and somewhere down there, Charlotte would be opening the envelope. Reading the note, and looking at a grainy photograph. Julia sat on the raised edge of the pathway as a feeling of desperation flooded over her. Her life was crumbling around her, she was a marionette tossed in the wind, only the strings holding her back. She had worked so hard at college, developed a style, visited every gallery in London with prints and became known. The school had employed her as an art teacher. That gave her time to work and money to live on, and she had met Charlotte. And now, I've got to explain the unthinkable to my lover. Deny, the undeniable, because the camera never lies. Until 4 years ago, Julia hadn't believed in love at first sight. The idea that you could see someone and expect to spend the rest of your life with them came straight off the pages of childish romances. The chance of finding a partner so randomly would be impossible to calculate. Then she walked into the bank that lunchtime, and it was like seeing a painting for the first time, an experience, an emotion. A flood of feelings welling up inside her. The surprise for Julia was that the subject of her affection was another woman. A little older than herself, dark hair and a smile. For a second, Julia had been struck dumb, then asked her to cash a check. She knew that seeing her again would not be the same, how could it be? A moment that changed your life set standards and opened doors. But it was, only this time, the smile was not for a customer but a genuine greeting. 4 months later, they sat in a bar. Sipping wine, and Julia had broached the subject, knowing it was a risk. From that moment on, nothing could be the same. Of course, we could move in together. As she heard herself saying it, Julia knew what the answer would be. She had declared her hand too soon, pulled the line too hard and would lose the person she had come to love. They had shared meals and films, sat and cried at the end of Notting Hill, drinking red wine and laughing at the jokes. Then she heard the feed line. How long were you thinking of staying? And Julia had tried to stop herself from smiling. Stop herself from panicking, stop herself from running out of the door. But she remembered her line and just hoped she could say it without choking. Indefinitely. Then they were both smiling and crying, not for the ending of a film, but their own future. But nothing is stable. 4 years and like trains, leaving a station on parallel tracks, they were heading in different directions. Months earlier, Julia knew there was a problem. 4 years of pleasure eroded in a few weeks. By what? A realization that you are only allowed so much happiness? That life is not about fresh cream on eaten mess pudding, there has to be something savory. In this case, unsavory. Another lover. Nearer the edge, she could make out the faint festoon of lights on Eastbourne Seafront. A sad memory of happier summer days or preparation for Christmas? She could imagine the lamps tossing in the gale-force wind, clinging to their cable, like sailors hanging onto a lifeline in the frozen waters. Julia turned her back on Eastbourne and headed along the pathway. For 4 years, she had lived with her partner, each day waking, knowing it might be the day that Charlotte saw through her. The day when the dynamic changed and Charlotte realized the truth. She needed Charlotte more than Charlotte needed her. And with that realization came the inevitable decline, from love and respect to casual friendship, finally, to contempt and loathing. Julia knew the pathway as well as she knew the paths on the clifftop and was determined to avoid the destructive force of rejection. She knew she had to be the one to leave, and like a self-fulfilling prophecy, she was the one who had realized the time had come. The photographs were a catalyst, but the end was inevitable. Chapter 1. It took two swings of the solid iron enforcer, and the front door burst open, crashing against the wall. It was like cracking an egg with a mallet. Detective Sergeant Martin Tinsley nodded to the uniformed officers and was in the hall, then at the lounge, in a couple of seconds. Detective Constable Eddie Hopkins followed. The two stopped dead at the lounge doorway. Jesus. It was the most profane thing Tinsley had heard Eddie say. Eddie, call the ambulance, and secure the area, lads. Tinsley was taking in as much of the scene as possible before the circus started. A few vital seconds that gave him a feeling for the room just as the murderer left it. Ahead was the same view of the Thames estuary, Tinsley could see from his flat. The room was bigger than his, the furniture more luxurious, but the biggest difference was the body in the middle of the lounge carpet. She was lying on her back, and Tinsley estimated that she was about the same age as himself. Tinsley had never seen a charnel house, but this came as close as he wanted. The body lay in a red abstract design on the pure white carpet. It could have been the work of a modern painter, a disastrous spillage of paint or food. But they all know what it was. He stepped forward and pressed his fingers into the side of her neck, she was still alive. 5 minutes later, the scene had changed. Now the lounge seemed full of people, and Martin knew it would get worse. The policeman looked down at the two paramedics, thumping the body or commanding everyone to stand back as a machine whined into life. Ready. Thump. The body convulsed, and the paramedic started to thrust down on her chest. Will she live? D.S. Tinsley looked around and knew that if she died, this would be a murder scene. But the fight to save her had compromised the murder scene too much for an easy conviction. It didn't matter if she lived or died, her attacker would walk free. Will she live? He asked again. I heard you the first time. How the hell should I know? The medic looked up from her task, trying to thump life into the body. I doubt it, and if she did, well, you know. D.S. Martin Tinsley knew what she was talking about. The woman had lost too much blood. Her oxygen-starved brain was dying even as he watched. If she lived, what kind of life could she lead? This flat's worth a bit, boss. Who is she? D.C. Eddie Hopkins asked, and Martin shrugged. I thought you lived here. It's not Coronation Street, Eddie. She could have lived on Mars for all I know about the kind of people who can afford this. Martin looked around the room again, seeing the decoration and the furniture. Ahead of him, the wide glass doors led onto a balcony overlooking the Thames. A large mirror on one wall and a huge, almost abstract painting on the opposite wall. For a second, Tinsley gazed at the intense dark blues and almost black areas, then bright highlights that almost hurt your eyes. It was the crashing sea against the solid rocks. Then he was back in the cockpit of life and death. The paramedic looked up at him. If we could get her into intensive care, I reckon she'd have a 1 in 100 chance. She said. But. If we move her, she's got a 100% chance of dying. At that moment, two more paramedics arrived with more equipment. In a couple of seconds, they were giving her a blood transfusion. For a while, she started to look brighter, then, they discovered the source of the blood. We raised her BP. Martin found he was the only one smiling. What's the problem? No one answered him, And he watched as they started to turn the patient, and now he understood. The knife was still in her. She had fallen back onto the blade. It would have twisted inside her, but until they moved her, it had sealed the wound. But it wasn't sealing it now. It was the catalyst for action. Three of them flipped her over onto her front and ripped her clothes apart. And there, in her spotless olive-colored skin, a tsunami of blood poured onto the carpet. "We are losing her." Martin stood back as one of the second group tore open dressings and handed them down to the woman in charge. "If we pull it out, we might cause more internal bleeding," one of them said to her. "Thanks, that hadn't occurred to me." She glanced up from her job. "It's going to have to come out. We can't hope to stop the bleeding with it in." She looked around for concurrence, and there were nods. Two men placed dressings around the blade as she pulled the small kitchen knife out. As it came free, Eddie Hopkins was ready with a plastic evidence bag. Two thick dressings seemed to stop the flood. Smiles passed around the four green uniforms, and Martin sensed a moment of relaxation. Then Dr. Emma Kennedy died. 10:24. For a second, Martin knew they could save her. Use the machine again and pump more blood into her. He knew they would turn her back and start to thump her chest, forcing the heart to pump life-giving blood to the brain. But none of that happened, and as he watched, they began to clear the area. Martin's shoulders slumped, and he noted the time in his notebook, as did one of the others, and the atmosphere changed. Now there was a calm resignation to their task. They needed to clear themselves from the crime scene and leave as much evidence as possible undisturbed. Martin turned to the view of the Thames estuary and made the phone call. "It's Martin, boss. You'd better get the wheels rolling. This is a murder scene." Eddie looked across at him and shrugged. "Of course, it's bloody contaminated. We've had four paramedics in here, plus me and Eddie trying to save the poor bitch. I know the ropes." Eddie wandered over to the window and started to open the balcony doors. "Don't touch anything, Eddie. You might get arrested as the murderer." Martin turned back to the phone and faced away from the window. "Yeah, I know, boss. We've all got to learn." Martin felt a moment of animosity as he listened to Detective Inspector Stafford. "No, I'm fine, nothing since the weekend. Let me get my teeth into this one. You know." Again there was a pause, then Martin nodded and pressed the off button. "Stafford's coming. He's phoning the police doctor, so the circus will kick off in 10 minutes. He turned to the two uniformed officers. "Get some tape and make some effort to stop people gathering near the door. And use some of the cones in my Land Rover. Try to make a bit of space in the car park." One of the paramedics turned to him. "She was one of ours. A doctor at the hospital." "What can you tell me about her?" "About as much as you can tell me about your chief inspector, I'd guess. We move in different circles." "Superintendent. But I get the message." "She was a cardio specialist. Married, to another doctor, a GP, I think. You'll get all the bollocks on the media, but I think she was well-liked. I sat in Costa with her and chatted, you know, about nothing in particular. Most doctors think we are glorified porters, but she seemed to respect the profession." He shrugged. Martin started to note all the names and details the paramedic could give him. Then, he was alone in the luxury flat with a dead body. A few minutes later, Eddie stood by the door with packs of white suits and a plastic bag for discarded material. It would all be gathered for the forensic laboratory. "I guess we better make an effort, Martin." He handed Martin a suit. Eddie, his reliable second in command. Shorter than Tinsley but more solid. But the truth was, several criminals in the South End area had made the wrong presumption about Tinsley's slender build and university education, ending up handcuffed in the back of a police van. Martin took the suit and started to put it on. "Bit bloody late, we've been here for an hour." Although he hated the white suits, mask and gloves, it allowed him to start to look around the flat. Martin always reminded himself of the truism. Most crimes are solved in the first 24 hours. But he knew that these few minutes of peace before the circus took over were critical. If something was here, this was the moment to find it. An antique mahogany desk stood beside the balcony door, and Martin wandered over to it. "Take a glance around the rest of the flat, Eddie. If you meet the murderer, give me a shout, and I'll wander in and give you a hand." He took out his phone, photographed the desktop, and then picked over the paperwork with the end of his biro. The doctor had been working on her accounts. There was an open folder with receipts and bills with penciled ticks and dates on the desk. "Self-assessment time," he mumbled to himself and lifted the edge of the folder. Underneath was a sheet of paper with some printing across the middle. He pulled the paper out and stood looking at the message. R1413. Down one side, someone had written a list of amounts, dates and abbreviations. He was staring at the sheet when he heard D.I. Terry Stafford putting on his white suit. Murder, then? Tinsley nodded. She's a married doctor, in her mid-30s. Her partner is a local GP, and she died at 10:24. Well-liked, according to the paramedic. No apparent financial problems. $20,000 in their joint, current account. Stafford raised his eyebrows. She was doing her tax at the desk. He showed Stafford the sheet of paper. I found this under a folder, boss. Payments and dates, blackmail? A punter got fed up with paying? That's a bit of a leap. D.I. Terry Stafford looked at the sheet without touching it. Then his eyes returned to darting around the lounge. Odd amounts for blackmail. But, who knows, maybe the decimal point's in the wrong place. Stafford shrugged, then looked at the body. It'll be the husband. Debble or quits? He took a £5 note from his wallet, folded it and put it in Tinsley's top pocket. The doctor is coming to declare her dead, and forensics. Then we can start to churn through this stuff. Relations? Stafford asked. Eddie is trying to reach her husband. As I say, he's a GP, but you know what it's like to get an appointment. Martin raised his eyebrows. Tell me about it. She was lying on her back when we came in, and the door was solid until we forced it. So she could have known the murderer. Let them in, or maybe they were here already. Turned away to walk to the window. Then the attack started. But there were only screams from the woman, no other raised voices. So she knew the murderer and was relaxed enough to turn her back on him. Tinsley nodded. Or her, but it was pretty frenzied from then on. I counted 3 stabs. Stafford glanced across the room. Nothing seems out of place. Tinsley followed his gaze. None of the ornaments were disturbed, the chairs and magazines on the small table were all in the right place. The way people live. They read the paper and leave it on the coffee table. It doesn't add up. You know, you go from a quiet discussion about something to a frenzied attack and the time it takes to turn around. Is anything stolen? I've not had a chance to look around, but somehow, I doubt it. There's no sign of burglary, and we were here in no time at all. The DI turned to Martin and looked straight at him, and frowned. Let me do this, boss. You know what I'm thinking. Stafford said. It's not a problem. I can handle it. If I find you're drinking before we have a conviction, I won't protect you. There was silence between the two men. When was the last drink you had? The weekend. I can still smell the vodka. Bloody hell, Martin, if I breathalyzed you now, you'd be over the limit. Stafford pulled a grim face. This morning. Just a slug to shake off the dust. The DI shook his head. Sorry, Martin. I can't trust you. This is different. Look, you know we've been chasing dogs for the past 2 years. This is something I can get my teeth into. You were on the fast track. The wonder kid. The one that I thought I'd be proud of when I retired. I could see you wearing the uniform with all the flashes, handing me the silver watch. You know I can do this. I know you can do it. What I don't know is whether you want to do it. You come to me and tell me that you're bored with chasing dog nappers and looking at burglar alarms, but what I see is a slug of gin to get you going in the morning. That's not fair. One morning I need a sip. It's not life-threatening. It's not illegal. Well, maybe it should be. You were the professor, the one we asked when we needed an answer. Now we ask Google and hope for the best. Stafford stood looking at Tinsley. That makes me think. Martin said, and Stafford looked past him at the view. You know about my future. Don't give me that bollocks, Martin. What are you going to do if you leave? Become a teacher? Jesus, you drink now, you stand in front of 3D and try to teach them about Greek philosophers, and you'd be an alcoholic before the Christmas holidays. No, you are a copper through and through. Then let me prove it. Give me this chance. Stafford wandered to one side, then turned back. You say she's a senior doctor at the local hospital. That makes her a personality, not some gang member who knows the risks. She will be a pillar of the community, someone who is on the point of curing cancer. A charity worker who has saved the lives of defenseless children, and there will be photographs of her at the village fete, stroking white rabbits and judging the gymkhana. For a second, he was silent. You cock this up, take a press conference smelling of vodka, or walk down the corridor in anything less than a dead straight line, they won't just eviscerate you. The press will be after my blood too. What can I say? You could promise that would be a start. Remember, you have my future in your hands, that might help. How old are you?
30.
You are 36. In 5 years, you'll be over 40, and in another 5, you'll be as old as me. But you won't be a DI, you'll be lucky to be a PC. This could make you or break you, your shout. And remember what I always say. Martin nodded. Don't make a name for myself, trying to make a name for myself. Good. Eddie was at the door holding back the forensic team. Stafford looked back at the scene over the Thames. This is the same as your flat, isn't it? I wish. No, mine's lower down and about half this size. Yeah, and there's no dead body on the carpet. Don't let me down, Martin. The following day Martin Tinsley arrived at the station and knew he needed another coffee. Half an hour earlier, he had grabbed a Mac breakfast and 2 black coffees, and now Martin was not certain about either choice. But he had restricted his morning tonic to a mouthful. Tinsley pressed the button on the lift. There's no benefit in going cold turkey. Nothing happens until the autopsy. As the lift doors started to close, and a hand reached in and stopped them. You in a daze or something, Tinsley? I thought I heard you talking to yourself. DCI Manning squeezed through the doors before they were open. Sorry about that, Charlie, thinking about the murder in the flat near me. The lift shuddered into life. You worried you're next on the agenda? Charlie Manning coughed a laugh. As tall as Tinsley but a good 3 stone heavier. Martin had said Charlie didn't need a cosh, he could flatten an elephant with his forearm. Charlie rippled his shoulders as the lift started. How's Flaky? Flaky? Sorry, for seniors only. Charlie winked at Tinsley and lightened his tone. How's the terrier? Fine. You know. Yeah, I know. The lift slowed, and Martin was glad to end this awkward conversation, but Charlie Manning carried on. Tell me about the murder. They walked along the corridor, and Manning made it clear that his office was the destination. Once they were there, the DCI clicked the button on the kettle. Sit. Nothing formal here. A minute later, he handed Tinsley a mug of black coffee and sat behind his desk. It's early. You know, we've got her on the table today, but we all know what killed her, a kitchen knife in the back. The paramedic said everyone liked her, in my book, that means she was probably a pain in the arse. Manning sipped his coffee and smiled. Was it the husband? He's a GP, and it was a surgery day. He might have slipped out, but I think someone would have noticed. We've not interviewed the people at the surgery yet, I'll get Eddie Hopkins down there today. He shrugged. What about forensics? Plenty of that. They can place me, Eddie and the 4 paras at the crime scene, also the husband, but he lives there. They destroyed any prints on the knife when they pulled it out of her. I guess, technically, the paramedic killed her. Martin smiled and sipped his coffee. Why the interest? It's a high-profile case, I'm a senior officer. It's what we do, nose around and look for trouble. Again, there was the laugh that spoke of years of smoking. Yeah, right. I'll lay my cards on the table. The old man's worried, not about you, but this is high profile, and there might be pressure for Flaky to step aside. If you see what I mean. He rippled his shoulders and took another sip of coffee. To put it bluntly, if I have to take it over, I don't want to be the poor sod who tries to plant seedlings when a herd of elephants have just trampled the soil so hard it looks more like formica than good loam. If you get my drift. He nodded at Martin and carried on. You thinking of looking at the scene again, soon? Manning's voice was lighter, and he raised his eyebrows. Let me log in, and we'll run down there if you fancy. Charlie Manning beamed and nodded. The car park in 10 minutes. No need to make it public. No one will see us holding hands. As Martin walked out, he could hear the laugh that ended in a cough. Half an hour later, DCI Charlie Manning stood at the lounge door and looked in. They were both wearing full forensic outfits. Let me show you around, Charlie. I don't need a guided tour, thanks. Martin walked into the lounge, and in his mind, he could see the body of the young woman sprawled across the white carpet in a pool of her blood. What had been brilliant red yesterday had dried to a dull brown. On various surfaces, Martin could see fingerprint dust. The room looked odd. The day before, it had been a hive of medics trying to save a life. All that was left was the debris of their struggle. It reminded Tinsley of Christmas parties in his parents' house. Everyone enjoying the chaos of drinks and food. Children keen to show off new toys and an uncle sitting in a corner smoking a small cigar. Then the clear-up the following day. The same room smelt of stale smoke, glasses sheltered behind chair legs with the dregs of cheap beer, and the harshness of daylight, showing every detail. Nice room. Shame about the carpet. Charlie shrugged. Some people couldn't live here after a killing. I don't know what it is. You ask them if they believe in ghosts, and they laugh. But you mark my words, this flat will sell for a song when the case is over. Tinsley shrugged. He was looking at the painting. Is that worth anything? If it were in a church hall bazaar, I'd say about $5. But here, this prominent, I reckon you could start by adding 3 knots to that. $5,000? At least, which is interesting. And it goes along with what we found around the flat, money and jewelry. So, not a burglary. If they were disturbed, they might have overreacted. Perhaps they thought she'd be working in the hospital. She appears and pays the price, and they scarp her before you arrive. Tinsley shook his head. There are 10 floors in this block, 3 flats on this floor, all expensive and full of stuff like this. We are not talking about a random thug who sees a window open and tries his luck. If they were robbing the flat, they knew what the score was. No, I think this was a targeted attack. They wanted to kill her. But the question is why? Tell me about this painting. You look interested in it. Charlie frowned at Tinsley. Paintings are often metaphors for something else. There is a message. Even when you think about Georgian portraits of Lord and Lady something, it's not just a record of them in front of their manor. There's a message, here, I think we are talking about conflict. You've got the never-ending thrash of the waves, trying to erode the solid rocks. It could be a metaphor for a relationship. Charlie Manning rolled his shoulders again but did not look convinced. So, what you're saying is, because they bought a painting of the sea, they had a tricky marriage. The thing is, it's not a calm sunset over Lee. The waves are in turmoil, the sea is boiling, trying to find a way to destroy her. And someone did. Manning finished Tinsley's thought. More likely, her husband slipped home when he had a so-called emergency to check up on her and found her having it away with the gardener. You were all heart, Charlie. Practical. I like the simple answer. I can understand that. I bet you'll find more than one type of DNA on the bedsheets. Then you'll be looking for her boyfriend, that will flush all the bull about them being a loving couple, right down the bog. For the next 10 minutes, they looked around the flat then drove back. At his desk, Tinsley found a note tucked under the corner of the phone. Did you get the bedsheets checked for DNA? What did Charlie Manning think of the flat? My office. D.S. Liz Brown was standing at her desk. You okay? Martin held up the note, grimaced at her and wandered towards the glass box. If you are going to get your arse kicked, remember the book down the trousers. She said, and Tinsley popped a peppermint into his mouth. Chapter 2. The deep note of the bus engine reminded criminal psychotherapist Steve Bailey that it was the end of another consultation. During the previous hour, Steve and the patient might have revisited some of the patient's deepest secrets. Open doors that had remained shut for years or discussed topics that were almost as painful to Steve as the patient. Those thoughts need to be packed away for a later discussion. That demanded an intuitive awareness of time, but now the Eastern Counties Bus Company controlled Steve's timing. She knew she was slipping, and it was not just the anonymous letters. For the past 6 months, Steve had been revisiting the textbooks she had lumbered into the loft. Books, too precious to discard but not relevant to her current career. The latest addition to her library, Current Surgical Therapy 12th Edition, had arrived at the beginning of the week, and she was delighted to delve back into familiar pages. Psychiatry was fine, but she missed real medicine, the stress and pressure of the operating theater. It had never been her intention to switch from heart surgery to talking therapy 10 years earlier. But having seen the professor's hands shaking, Steve had taken control of a complex procedure, crossed a line, and her options were made clear to her. Steve had saved the patient but queered her career pathway. Had the patient died, she might have got away with the breach of etiquette. The professor would have taken her to one side, put his arm around her and commiserated with her. Then offered her some of the personal tutorial sessions he was renowned for. That would have secured her future in the hospital. However, the patient had survived and flourished. The next day, he had sat erect in his bed and thanked Steve for saving his life. It was a comment that turned her breach of etiquette into a disaster. At first, she thought she could weather the storm. Then she realized the depth of loathing, and Steve hoped that another firm would be glad to take her. She would become an orthopedic surgeon or a urologist, but her pathway was blocked, she was blackballed. Her senior tutor suggested that she took a year out and tried a different hospital, Or he could talk to a friend in psychiatry. We both like a project, so you know what it's like when it nears an end. I'm excited at the prospect of moving on to the next phase and sad to be moving on. You know, it's a bit like dumping a boyfriend. The new fellow is great, but you enjoyed some good times with the dump, hey? Steve smiled and wondered where this was going, but the patient carried on, oblivious of Steve's slippage. You know, when the plasterers and the electricians were working away, it filled my mind. Steve remembered her project, creating 3 suites in her house for paying guests. I suppose the truth is that the project is a substitution strategy. But the question is, what for? The patient looked sideways at the bus, and Steve knew they were on the edge of discovering the truth. Whatever I say will make me sound like a teenager. The atmosphere had changed. It was like opening a freezer door, and the patient smiled without humor. You used the word, strategies. I have endless strategies. Did you know children of any age are allowed in pubs now? So even those aren't safe. How long have you been trying? 8 years. Everything was going to be easy. Donald is a junior partner, me is a part-time solicitor, and 2 kids in kindergarten. Again she snorted without humor. Steve's shoulders slumped. 6 months and now she knew the problem. So, you find yourself in a strange town, no job, no friends and just the two of you in a huge house by the Thames, and you are surprised that you are bored and fed up? The patient smiled at her. It was the Kleenex moment. As they carried on, Steve realized what she had meant about ending a project. For the past 2 years, Steve had been restoring an old sports car. I had been fun, but what she saw, derelict in a barn a week earlier, made the TR4 look like a toy. Steve looked out of the window. The passengers were in the bus's warmth and security, and it was the end of the session. The bus has beaten us today, I'm sorry we are running a little late. Steve looked hard at the patient as they stood, 5 years older and at a guess, 5'9", almost as tall as herself. For a second, the two women stood silently. It sounds like an odd thing to say, but your condition is real, which is a good starting point. Unfortunately, there's no plaster other than the pills for the time being. The patient smiled at Bailey and left with a promise to phone if things became challenging. The buzzer on her desk interrupted her navel gazing. I guess you're alone. A few seconds later, Jessica Harris opened the door and brought in the second post in a folder of letters for her to sign. I've put a ring around the flat that we should buy. Well, you should buy it, and I can use it whenever I have the grandchildren to stay. It was typical of Jessica to start a conversation halfway through, assuming the listener's intelligence would allow them to catch up. So, we are buying a flat, are we? Might I ask where this one is? Steve smiled. Jessica was always coming up with little schemes. Felixstowe. It's very nice. The beach is okay, and they have a little pier, and it's not too far, a couple of hours at the most. Less from where I live. I thought we were buying a flat in Frinton. Why on earth would I want one in Felixstowe? Well, I assumed that was why you had the Ipswich Inquirer sent to us. It arrived this morning. Get onto them in the morning and cancel it, will you, Jessica? I tried. They say the subscription is prepaid for the next 3 months. Steve smiled. Actually, I think the flat would be a good investment, you know, somewhere to put your money, and we'd all enjoy it. Jessica, we are not buying a flat in Felixstowe, or Frinton, for that matter. Steve said. I was just saying. There's no need to get cross. With that, her secretary put the remainder of her work on the desk and turned to leave. I opened a private and personal envelope. Part question and part apology. It's a crank. Steve said. A sales pitch. Give them another week, and we'll get something that decodes it, and it will tell us about a new wonder drug. No, it's not. I phoned some of the other medical secretaries, and they've not got anything like it. Steve laughed at her. Oh, my God. We've not got the MedSec Mafia on the case now, have we? Jessica sat in the patient's chair and looked straight across the desk at Steve. This is not the first you've received. I can tell. There was silence between them for a full 5 seconds. The truth is, I don't know what they are. Steve admitted. How many have you received? Steve's nostrils flared. She hated Jessica quizzing her, especially when she didn't have an answer. 4 so far. They're all the same. Just different messages. And no, I haven't spoken to anyone about them, and no, I don't know what they are. Jessica raised her eyebrows. I can tell you that. They're a threat. She hesitated, then carried on unbidden. We deal with some, let's say, singular people in here, They're not all like Emily Bush, who just needs her head patting and the odd word of encouragement. Some of our clients are killers, and worse. I'll tell you what. If we get another, we'll call in the fuzz. Steve had seen an American earlier in the day and tried to copy Middleton's Bronx accent and failed. Jessica swept the letters off Steve's desk and stood. It's all very well joking about it. As I say, we deal with some very marginal people in here. Steve smiled a little and tried to dismiss the problem. Jessica shook her head. At the door, she turned and told Steve that she would clear the office and make her way home in 20 minutes. It's my turn to cook. I thought it was always your turn. Steve smiled at her. No, sometimes Sainsbury's does the business. And she turned to go. Are you just about to leave? I'll walk with you if that's okay. Jessica smiled, and they walked to their cars, chatting about the flat, Steve happy to indulge her secretary, so long as she had company to her car. 30 minutes later, Steve pushed the front door open against the accumulated mail. She dumped the junk mail and took the Christmas cards and bills through to her kitchen, fearing there would be a hand-delivered envelope amongst the pile but knowing that never happened. By now, Steve knew the pattern, the plain envelope hand-delivered to the surgery, Thursday morning. But her hands shook as she went through the current pile. There was nothing of interest, and she could open the cards over her meal, a Tesco pasta from the freezer. While her dinner heated, she ran through the Ipswich paper. She was starting at the back, plowing through the sports and small adverts. Finally, she turned to the front page. Crash GP fails breath test? The doctor had driven off the slip lane of a major road, and medics said she was stinking of whiskey. The last patient of the day had died 2 hours after the doctor said he was in good health. She turned to page 2 to continue reading, and there in front of her was an older but very recognizable school friend. For a second, Steve's shoulders slumped as she read the article, and she tried to remember everything about Sheila Lockwood. All that came to mind was Sheila running like a hare straight at some poor defender, red-faced and wielding a hockey stick. She laughed at the image for a second and decided she must get in touch, but then she stopped. It was one thing to put her arm around Sheila, but to do so now, uninvited with one of their group, was something else. How naive they had all been. Halfway through the GCSE year, they started to form groups, 5 or 6 girls who would be your allies, your closest friends and support, when you needed it. They were already in houses and years, but sometimes, you feel the need for a closer family of friends in a boarding school. So, the groups had formed, and, inevitably, each group acquired a name. One was the Sextuplets. 6 girls who rolled their skirts up a notch when it was time for re. Steve racked her brain for the names of other gangs. But as some of them came to mind, she couldn't bring herself to say her group's name, even to the space in the kitchen. The dreams they thought were plans, the fantasies embroidered into pictures, the objectives they knew they could achieve, destroyed in a single juvenile act. Steve knew they would have striven to put those years behind them. But they'd all remember sitting in the headmistress's office when she destroyed their dreams, her words ingrained into their souls. When you are a child, you think and act like a child, but when you grow, you cast off your childish ways and act like an adult. At the age of 16, they had all grown up very quickly. Chapter 3. The action kicked off at 8 in the Star and Garter. PC Graham Blake, from Traffic, was the groom. Since he was a popular member of the crew at Southend Police Station, the crowd swelled to the point where they outnumbered the regulars. Bloody hell, mate, if this lot put a fiver in the pot for your collection, you'll be off to Bermuda, not Brighton for your honeymoon. Eddie Hopkins said and watched the last of the regulars leave the bar. Drinking with the force was not a guarantee of popularity in most areas of the town. They would come in tomorrow and moan about the rowdy behavior of the cops. Hopkins could hear the moans now. One law for the effing public and another for the boys in blue. It didn't matter. They were giving Blake a bloody good send-off. Since there was no one else in the bar and were spending money, the publican started a karaoke machine, and the evening took off. Someone pressed Martin Tinsley into the spotlight, put a blonde wig on him, and he started to sing the words off the screen. At first, I was afraid, I was petrified. Kept thinking I could never live without you by my side. But then I spent so many nights thinking how you did me wrong. And I grew strong, and I learned how to get along. The bass cut in, and he was off. Now he didn't need the screen until the second verse. He camped up flirting with the officers during the instrumental part, then grabbed Graham Blake, and the two sung and groped their way through the third verse. There were flashes all around the bar from the glitter ball in the ceiling, and Martin felt happier than he could remember for a long while. The case was going well, and someone he knew was getting married. Better than all of that, he had done something he had not done since he was in the student union bar, and it felt great. Then the music changed, someone pushed him to one side, and the groom was alone on the tiny stage as the loudspeakers started to play the stripper. An aisle opened up, and all eyes turned to a woman clad in a police uniform, assuming the superintendent wore a tight mini skirt, fishnet tights and no shirt under her jacket. Someone stepped forward and managed to pin a note onto her back. In large letters was the name of one of Martin's team. D.S. Liz Brown. But the D.S. was struck through and replaced with D.I., D.C.I., Super, and finally, not crossed out Chief Super. The stripper knew the score. Her job was to humiliate, in a jokey way, the groom. But the ammunition they'd given her added to her portfolio. Over the next few minutes, she managed to get most of her clothes off while keeping the police jacket and hat on. Martin could see Graham going red as she slipped her hand down the front of his trousers and managed to pull a police truncheon out with a startled look on her face. The men erupted, cheering and shouting. Like everyone else, after 4 pints of real ale and 2 vodkas, Martin thought this was very funny. She pulled Martin onto the stage and started to strip him, and he laughed and acted up to the chairs. Eventually, he was down to his vest and underpants, and the boos and catcalls were almost deafening. Then the music changed, and tub thumping was booming out. And the entertainment became more raucous. Martin retrieved his clothes, retreated to his table and dressed. He realized that 3 pints had stacked up while entertaining the troops and managed to down the first of these before he had his trousers on. Then sat back to enjoy the ritual humiliation of Graham Blake and the pleasant haze that comes from just the right amount of alcohol. A period between sober and drunk, when you believe anything is possible. You could become a writer or artist, a singer or musician. What could possibly stand in your way? I hear you're got the murder sorted. No work. Not tonight. Martin said. Younger than himself and a bit shorter, Martin didn't recognize him. Perhaps he was new, or in one of the smaller stations, he was in civvies tonight. But when Martin was halfway through his 2nd pint, the stranger arrived with another. Cheers. Martin said and nodded to the glass of clear spirit. Tony Grease. They shook hands, and Martin drank half the vodka. I don't think I know D.S. Brown. Liz. Or should I say, Lippy Liz? He hesitated. She's okay. Almost one of the boys. Oh right. Yeah, that fathoms. No. Martin shook his head and wished he hadn't. Nothing like that. No, no, she's all woman. So, is the Lippy some other kind of service she offers? For a second, Martin didn't follow, then he burst out laughing as he realized. No. Well, I don't know. You could be right. And he drifted into his own thoughts for a second. So, she's your boss on this murder you're stuck on? I hate it when the governor gives you a hard time, it must be worse if it's a tart. No, Liz is okay. Anyway, we'll be making an arrest, as they say before the end of the week. He raised his eyebrows. I bet it's the husband. Martin lifted the glass and looked over the room at Tony Grease. 1/2 hour and 2 more pints that Martin bought for his new friend and Martin's taxi arrived. Nice to meet. Glass slipper time. If you need a willing DC when you make inspector, remember my name. Martin smiled and was home before midnight. At 9 the following morning, Martin read the brief note on his desk. Top floor 10. Find me. T. At 9:55, the 2 officers walked into Superintendent Harrison's office. Good morning, gentlemen. Don't sit, we'll be brief. I just wanted to congratulate you on the stunning performance on the Dr. Kennedy murder. I love to hear that we have cleared up such a brutal murder in so short a time. Neither man spoke for a second, then Tinsley could feel Stafford frown and start to say something and jumped in. We've not charged anyone yet. Tinsley stretched the adverb and knew he was in trouble. But you have this brutal murderer in custody? Harrison asked. No. Interviewed under caution? No. Well, don't keep me in suspense. Who is the brutal killer? It was the 3rd time Harrison had used the word brutal, and alarm bells clashed in Tinsley's head louder than his hangover. Stafford tried to calm the waters. There is no forensic evidence that points to anyone other than her husband. Tinsley knew that Stafford was busking. So, it's the husband? They both nodded, and, for the first time, Tinsley glanced at the folded copy of the local paper on Harrison's desk. And suddenly, he wanted to get out of the office as soon as possible. So, if I arrange a press conference and announce that an arrest is imminent and her husband is a person of interest, I would not be sticking my neck out too far. They both stayed silent, and the hush stretched for longer than Tinsley could believe. And he remembered the ride at a theme park, where a spring wound up, then launched the cars off, like a bullet out of a gun. This moment felt the same. "How's the voice, Mr. Tinsley?" Mr. Tinsley, not Sergeant Tinsley, a cold blanket had been thrown over his head. "A little hoarse? You know, after last night's singing?" Tinsley stayed silent and waited for the body blow. And when it came, it was far worse than he could have feared. Harrison flipped the newspaper over, revealing the headlines and main photographs. There, in stark color, Martin Tinsley stood with a stripper, holding a microphone. The Liz Brown notice pinned to the front of his underpants. Harrison's voice was solid granite, and gradually, the volume increased into a crescendo. "It says you were singing the Gloria Gaynor hit, I Will Survive. I suppose I should ask you how long you think you can survive as a detective sergeant carrying on like this?" It was Graham Blake's stag night. "You know, just a bit of fun with the lads. There are more shots on page 3. But of course, you had more to celebrate than just the upcoming wedding. You had solved a brutal murder." Tinsley stayed silent, and now the tsunami hit him. "But it's all rubbish. There's no one in the custody suite, no interview under caution, no written confession. We have nothing. Then you arrive smelling of vodka, Econ 9, and were prepared to send me into a press conference with the biggest pile of bullshit I've heard in a long time. The fact is you have not solved the crime. You are nowhere near solving it. And shall I tell you how I happen to know that the husband of this poor doctor has an ironclad alibi for the time of her murder?" Tinsley could feel the earth moving under him. "I know he has an alibi because I've taken the trouble to look into it. I took the unprecedented step of talking to the surgery. I chatted to the people on the desk, who were happy to tell me about the staffing on that day. He was in his surgery from 9 a.m. through to 11 a.m., and he has a list of patients he can call as witnesses to prove this. That is, in addition to the practice nurse and the two receptionists." Harrison flipped the paper over to page 3, and Tinsley could not bear to look. "And in addition to you coming in drunk, letting slip to reporter information that might be slanderous, you have demeaned the reputation of a fellow officer. A blow-by-blow job account. You lied to me and implied to a member of the press that your colleague achieved her position by handing out sexual favors. In particular, blowjobs. I never said anything of the kind." "Then I'll quote." Harrison spun the paper around and ran his finger along a line of text highlighted with a yellow pen. "When I asked about Libby Liz offering sexual services to senior officers, my source said, you could be right." Tinsley turned red and remained silent. "So, you arrive here late this morning, stinking of drink. You made an unprofessional exhibition of yourself last night. And because you were drunk, the press thinks an innocent GP killed his wife. Oh, and as a bit of a sideshow, you have insulted a fellow officer suggesting she achieved her status by offering sexual services to senior members of this station." Now his voice was just a whisper. "And that means me." Chapter 4. Steve Bailey walked along the corridor with the confidence and professional gait of someone who has spent years in hospitals. But her appearance was at odds with her feelings. She loathed hospitals. Steve hated the smell, the battered decoration, and the sauntering patients. Worst of all, she hated the memories it brought back. "Can I help you?" A man in a white jacket stood beside her. "I'm looking for Onger Ward." 5 minutes later, she stood at the bedside of a sleeping patient, then decided to take a seat. 10 minutes later, Steve heard Sheila's breathing change. She was waking up. "Dr. Sheila Lockwood, I presume." The patient stirred and looked at Bailey through half-opened eyes. "I know that voice. The last time I heard it, I was wearing a school uniform and clear as ill. Have I died and gone to heaven, or more to the point, hell? No dream, or death, not yet anyway. Frankly, if you go to heaven, don't expect to see me there. Jesus, Bridge, what are you doing here?" "My God, I've not been called Bailey Bridge for 20 years. She sat down in the chair beside the bed and put the Scientific American on the locker, together with a copy of 50 Shades of Grey. "I came to see you, you twit. I read about you in the paper, and I thought the old twit needs a bit of love and understanding after her accident." Bailey surveyed the patient with a professional air. "Your charts are looking good, not sure about the face. I don't suppose that they've let you see yourself, but frankly, you look like shit. You are all heart, Bridge. You're supposed to cheer me up." Sheila touched Steve's hand. "Jesus, it's good to see you. Now I know someone's on my side. Do you want to tell me about it? No, not now. She stopped in mid-sentence and drifted off. Steve heard rhythmic breathing a moment later and went to the nurse's station and handed over her business card. My friend, how long has she been here? Let me have a look. Sheila came in just over a week ago. Multiple fractures, facial injuries from the airbag, as you can see, a broken collarbone from the seatbelt. Nothing internal, so she should be out in a couple of days. But she will need help, she has two broken fibulae. She was very lucky. The fireman who cut her out of the little Fiat said it looked like an empty drinks can, but it was strong enough to save her. She raised her eyebrows. She had to be cut out? The lorry that hit her had seen the crash coming and stood on his brakes. A second later, and it would have been a different story. You are friends with Sheila? School friends. After 20 years, and it's like you were still in the sixth form. Sheila became a GP, and I went on to be a psychiatrist. Psychiatrist? I'll have to watch what I say then. Bailey smiled. For the next hour, she sat with Sheila Lockwood, who drifted in and out of sleep until, eventually, she was wide awake. The thing is, Bridge, it was so idiotic. One of the coldest days of the year, frost on the ground and fog drifting off the Orwell. I should have been at a partner's meeting, and I'm sent on a wild goose chase, bloody receptionists. When I get out. She stopped mid-sentence. Anyway, I got into a Barney with a Range Rover on the slip road, and here I am. You were never one for backing down. Bailey shook her head. I should go and let you eat in peace. Please don't, there are things I want you to think about. My time is my own today. Jessica fancied a long weekend, so we both get a break. I never quite know who is the master and who the servant in our little setup. Sheila started her red Thai curry. This is the only grub that is edible here. I tried the chicken and ham pie, but they bring it back to life in a steamer. They both pulled faces. We had worse at school. They both laughed, then suddenly, Sheila was serious. Have you ever thought about it? You know, what happened. Occasionally, I wake covered in sweat. I dream about it. Then I go down and have a hot chocolate, it doesn't help. Steve said. I find that I'm thinking about it more and more. Steve looked past Sheila. I don't think it's something to dwell on. We are both medics, and we know the lies we tell people. The fact is that you don't get away with things, do you? Steve frowned, not following the argument. I have men in with cancer, and they go off to be cured and return to smile and thank me. Thank me for saving them. But when I ask, when I probe, they tell me about their incontinence, having to carry a spare pair of pants with him, and all the rest. We save them from cancer, but the truth is, you don't get away with it. She looked around. Things come back to bite you. You know where all this is coming from, don't you, Sheila? Steve said. You have a crash, receive a few obscure notes, and you end up here. There's nothing to occupy your mind, read 50 Shades. That will take your mind off things, well, most things. Steve laughed, trying to lighten her mood. No. It all started weeks ago. It's tricky to remember. She put her fork down and turned to Bailey. Like you, I've always woken up sweating and shaking, and that's not changed. But this is different. The HSA came over and cleared the tray. I know I am being targeted. The crash might have been random, but the phony call-out wasn't, neither was the abandoned complaint. Go on. Steve said. Over the past months. Things that I can't explain. Missed phone calls, abandoned visits to the worst places, and letters. It's a campaign, and I think it goes back to school. That's nonsense, and you know it. You add a couple of incidents and make it into a conspiracy. Don't get cross with me. I am the one on the receiving end of this, but you wait, and it will start to happen with you. Odd incidents, things that go bump in the night. Things you can't explain. It all stems from then. It all goes back to school. I can't believe you are wasting your breath saying this. Steve stood to leave. Listen to me. Sheila said. Steve stayed silent. Have you been in touch with any of the others? No. That part of my life stopped when I went to college. But it didn't, did it? Sheila stared straight at Steve. Which university did you go to? King's. No, you didn't. You went to Exeter for your medical training, I went to Loughborough. None of us got into the top universities. Perhaps we weren't good enough. Bailey tried to appease her. Bollocks, of course, we were good enough. We were the tops. Quintessential, we were the best, and we knew it. We had everything, and we had places. But we blew it and took what we could get. Jesus, Fiona ended up a year late into Montfort. You are such a snob, Sheila, you always were. There is nothing wrong with De Montfort. Bailey tried to lighten the atmosphere. No, but it's not Oxford. I spoke to her a few months ago, and she said that her father never got over it. You know that she dropped out? Steve shook her head. Anyway, that was a long time ago. What's it got to do with your current problem? What I am saying is that we all paid, but this is different. Sheila looked around as if someone was watching her. I had a patient in the surgery who spoke about it. Not in so many words, but spoke about school pranks coming back to bite people. It happens. This is nonsense. You are seeing a goat who's lost a horn and calling it a unicorn. Sheila shifted in her bed, trying to sit straighter. It's not nonsense. I was thinking about it before this incident. It all started so gently, I can't decide when. I see people who are paranoid all the time in the surgery. Sometimes you can't see the wood for the trees. Don't you call me paranoid. The problem is that someone like you can't see a hand in front of your face. You call someone paranoid when you can't think of an answer. I don't think this is paranoia, someone is out there trying to harm us. If you could hear yourself. You take this lightly, and you will be snuffed out. I missed death by less than a second. Had I been a second later, I would have been crushed under the wheels of a 30-tonner. That's not paranoia, that's a fact. The fact is, 2,000 people a year do get killed on the roads, and people still drive as if they are sniffing cocaine. Some people drive as if it is a competition. They may be stupid, selfish, or mindless aggressive thugs, but there's no malice, they're just wankers. You live in a different world to the rest of us. You sit in your surgery and see a string of people with mental conditions, so that's all you can see. Then someone presents a solid case, and you think it's schizophrenia or paranoia. I am not paranoid. Sheila struck the table with each of the explosive consonants. I know someone's targeting me. I guess we are back to our history lessons. Who, what, why, where and when. Have you thought about starting to write it all down? Sorting out what could be real and what could be imaginary. Imaginary. Jesus, are you joking? Does this all look like some kind of a psychotic incident? None of this is imaginary. I've got plaster, on both legs a broken collarbone, and God knows what my face looks like. Sheila paused. There was plenty of room. I felt the wheels bumping over the studs. You can imagine how much space there was, but the bugger kept coming, then bumps were coming from the left side of the car. I didn't dream that. Tell me about the other incidents, let's start to make a list with all the details, then we can chat about it. Why does that not surprise me? You don't change. Steve could hear her seething under her breath, trying to control her anger. You were always into making lists. She snorted, unamused. It was always you who started your turn with a list of the topics, subdivided, then cross-referenced with the weeks. By the end of the first week, you had better learning plans than the teachers. And look where it got us. Not to Oxford and the doors that could open, but a rundown surgery in Ipswich. I think I'd better go before you have a heart attack on top of everything else. Bailey said. Will you do something for me? Go down to Smith's and get a notepad and some pens. I'll make a list, but I expect you to listen to me and not treat me like one of your schizophrenics. And I want you to watch out. You ignore this, and it will snuff you out like a cheap candle. Steve hesitated and looked around the ward. I'll get the pad. Steve sat in the Costa coffee, waited for the baked potato and cheese, and pondered the earlier conversation. If they struck her off, or worse, sent her to prison, it would ruin Sheila. If she was using drugs and had complaints against her, she might have thought the crash was a good end. And as soon as she felt it, she dismissed it from her mind. There was no way her friend could be in such a state that she would take her own life. Her meal arrived, and Steve tucked in absent-mindedly. She had already bought the notebook and pen that Sheila had demanded, and after another half an hour, she made her way back to the ward. It was clear there had been a shift change, which was confirmed when Steve approached the nurse's station. I just wanted to take these into my friend Sheila Lockwood. She showed the junior her purchases. I think there is someone with her at the moment, but you can pop along and see. Steve turned left into the twilight of the corridor. Small wards were on minimum lighting on each side, and the whole place was quiet and restful, an ideal environment for sleeping patients. But that was not the image that panicked Steve as she left the security of the nurse's station. She remembered a film. The corridor with unseen procedures behind a closed door, but the screams kept her awake into adulthood. And now, Steve was in the same corridor. Walk to the bottom, make light conversation with her friend, be upbeat and lighten her load while her hands were sweating and her heart was racing. She leant against the wall and tried to slow her breathing, using the usual answer, the Bee Gees. Take a breath in on each 8, hold then breath out. Staying alive kept her alive. After 5 minutes, it worked. It always did, but the panic attack left Steve listless, exhausted and trembling a little. She never knew how long it lasted. Steve worked her way along the wall to the end room and sat at Sheila's bedside. 10 minutes later, Sheila woke, and Steve handed over the pad and pens. I'll do what you say, write it all down, for 2 reasons. Steve could feel another argument brewing. As you said, it will clear my mind and help to get things straight. But also, because, if I don't, I'll forget something that I later rely on in court, as they say. Steve smiled, she had heard the caution many times. But in return, will you do something too? Steve nodded. I've been thinking. You knew about the notes, something you said. Anyway, you knew about them. So either you sent them, or you've received some. Sheila looked straight at Steve. And I know you didn't send them. I got my first about 3 months ago. Steve Bailey sat down and watched Sheila nod at her. So who are you going to visit first? Steve hadn't got that far. Nicola? You'd need to be careful. Don't tell her you think it's a rouse, she'll charge you by the half hour. Have you seen her website? Steve shook her head. Janice? Pat's in America, I believe. Harvard. Steve raised her eyebrows. Janice? She's a barrister now. She'd charge you for parking on her driveway. Remember the Narrowline paper? And she refilled her own ink cartridges. Steve laughed. I didn't know that. Steve could see Sheila drifting. You were worried about this, aren't you? We all need to be. I'll stay the night if they'll let me. Sheila was almost asleep and just smiled at her. Steve wandered back to the nurse's station and proffered her card. A few minutes ago, I came back with a pad and pens for my friend Dr. Lockwood. Someone left a magazine on her table, and I wonder if you know who her visitor was? But there was no visitor's log, and Steve could feel animosity growing towards this interfering semi-professional. It was a term she heard pointed towards psychiatrists. The thing is, she feels vulnerable. Steve nodded to the nurse. If you have no objection, I shall be sleeping next to Sheila tonight. Would you be good enough to ask your nurse to find me a couple of blankets? 10 minutes later, a young nurse brought her a cup of tea, 2 blankets and a pillow. Chapter 5. The telephone rang in Martin Tinsley's flat, and he stumbled out of bed to reach it before the answer phone cut in. As he picked it up, he knocked the base unit onto the floor where it joined the previous day's newspaper, the foil trays that had contained a chicken curry and a pile of junk mail. Tinsley. You all right, Professor? I just thought I'd give you the heads up. No one's missed you yet, but they soon will. Eddie Hopkins was a recent member of the team, young, enthusiastic, clean-shaven and bright. Everything Martin could remember being, once. But now, the mantle of being on the fast track had moved on. What's the time, Eddie? 9:30, mate, and, believe me, if you are not here soon, someone will notice, and you will be looking at the lollipop job. It was a threat that DCI Terry Stafford sometimes made to the team. If they did not work harder, get the answers or arrest a prime suspect, they would find themselves back in uniform. He didn't mean as a PC but as a lollipop man or lady, Stafford was anything but sexist. Bit of a hangover, can you cover for me? No can do, boss. Talk is, we're being summoned to the glass box in an hour for the DCI to give us a presentation. The terrier won't give a stuff if I'm there or not. We are not talking about Stafford, he's not the new DCI. New DCI, what are you talking about? Word is Harrison will be in attendance. I believe Khan is sweeping the red carpet as we speak. That would be fucking typical. He laughed, but there was no humor in it. Done what I can, mate. I'll send a taxi round in 10. The line went dead, and Tinsley walked over to the curtains and pulled them back, letting the brilliant sunshine sear through his frazzled mind. He looked at his watch, the white squad car would be outside in less than 10 minutes, and he would owe another 2 traffic cops a case of beer at Christmas. More to the point now, Martin needed a shower and something to clear his head. Suddenly, he knew he was getting too old to enjoy a night out with the lads in a late-night curry. He shed the underpants, threw them onto the settee, walked to the bathroom, and turned on the shower. While it warmed up, he cleaned his teeth and shaved, then leapt under the almost scalding water. He lowered the temperature until the hot tap was closed. He was standing under the icy cold stream of water straight from the mains, hoping to clear his hangover. It didn't. After a few seconds, he jumped out and toweled himself down, rubbing his hair, trying to dry it and warm himself. Toothpaste was okay, but what he needed was in the fridge, and he pulled a bottle of vodka from the freezer and took a slug. He slipped on his work clothes, chino trousers, a casual shirt and a sports jacket. As he put on his second shoe and sock, there was a blast from a police siren downstairs. His lift had arrived. 10 minutes later, he was sitting at his desk, folding a sheet of paper into a paper airplane with the single word thanks written in felt-tip pen on the wings. He managed to flick it across the office and onto Eddie Hopkins' desk as the small managerial procession walked through the main door. Hopkins said that Terry would not be attending. He wondered if Stafford was ill or worse, and which of the regional DCIs that were always wandering the corridors of Police HQ Chelmsford would take over. But what he saw was almost like a bad dream. The new managerial party consisted of two members, Jim Harrison, the superintendent, and Liz Brown. Tinsley shook his head gently. She was grinning like a Cheshire cat while trying to keep her face straight and her eyes forward. 2 hours earlier, DS Liz Brown had stood in front of her governor's desk with a folder summarizing the current crop of crimes, rapes, muggings, and petty crimes, and started to bring DCI Stafford up to date. "I might look as if I care, Liz, but actually, I've got 2 months off. Doctor's orders." Liz Brown looked a bit surprised but plowed on regardless. "Don't be daft, Gov. I'll get a bag of donuts and a couple of coffees, then we can sort through these." She put the file down on the side cabinet and turned towards the door. "No, Liz." He stood up and lifted his jacket off the back of the chair. "This seat is yours for the next few weeks. Keep it hot for me. What did Schwarzenegger say? I'll be back." He had lowered his tone, but his voice was still estuary English rather than Californian Austrian. "That's a terrible impression." She shook her head and picked up the folder again. "Look, I'll pop down to the corner and get the lads in, and we'll crack through this in no time, then you can sit with your feet up while your drones beaver away." "No, Liz, I'm off for a couple of months. They say my blood pressure is too high or something. All bloody nonsense, but I need to watch my pension." Liz Brown sat in the chair, with her back to the office door, and frowned at her superior. "You can't go, Gov. I know we've been a bit sidetracked lately, but you can't just pull up stumps and walk. Bloody schools. Don't tell me schools are teaching girls to play cricket?" Terry Stafford opened the top drawer of his desk, and for the first time since she walked into the office, DS Liz Brown noticed a large carrier bag on top of the desk. Her boss rummaged through the drawer, pulling out various items, including a phone charger, a photograph, pens and a pot of change. Stafford put all these items into the bag, then saw the frown on Brown's face, put the pot of money back, and started on the next drawer. "You really are going, aren't you? When have you heard me more serious?" Brown did not answer. "So, no coffee and not even a single donut? It's your bloody donuts and cafe latte that have put up my blood pressure." He slipped his jacket on and moved around the desk. "You will handle anything that needs handling, store anything that needs my diamond touch, and anything you're undecided about, talk to the boss." By now, he was at the door. "Don't take chances. Don't make a name for yourself trying to make a name for yourself, and don't get sugar in my drawers." He glanced down to just below her waistline and smiled. "And talking about drawers." She smiled and punched him on the chest. "Now that I'm the boss, I could write out that sexual harassment claim I've meant to for the past 5 years. He didn't smile, just put out his hand, and she was just about to shake it but put her arm around his shoulders and kissed him on the cheek. Without further conversation, he walked down the aisle, ignoring comments from desks on both sides. At the door, he turned back, and she knew something was very wrong. Liz went back to her desk and sat for the next 5 minutes, thinking about the time they had spent together since she had arrived on his team. As South End had expanded, the need for another group had become apparent, even to the planners and bean counters in police headquarters in Chelmsford. Like most seaside towns, South End had seen its fortunes wax and wane. As South End changed, the population grew year on year, and law enforcement problems grew with it. With a population of almost 200,000, it was one of the 20 largest towns in the UK. Unlike most resort towns, most were under 50, the need for an extra team was obvious. They had formed from various police stations around Essex with different backgrounds, and Terry Stafford had developed them into a team. He had watched various members promote it, others leaving for pastures new and a near fatality leading to retirement. But what he had done best was to give them a sense of identity and individual self-confidence to work alone and bring their findings to the open meetings. Liz picked up the contents of her entree and took it into DCI Stafford's office. Then the internal telephone rang. Liz Brown. My office in 5 minutes. And Liz, bring the file. The line went dead, but she knew who it was. Liz Brown had hoped the superintendent's call would have given her a little more time to look through the remainder of Stafford's work. As it was, all she could do was to collect a folder of current cases and head for the top floor. End.